Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink, and we're continuing our series on the book of Daniel, and we've covered up through Daniel chapter 9, and we are going to continue today with Daniel chapters 10 and 11, and we have, there's so much to discuss here, and we have been bringing the book of Revelation into our discussions as well. I do not say, as someone in the forum has said, or someone has accused me of saying that Revelation is complete. I've never said any such thing. I have two primary documents on my website. One is, well, let me give you the website for those who aren't familiar, www.anglo-saxonisrael.com. In the prophecy section, there is the eighth beast of the apocalypse, which identifies all eight beasts starting from Egypt down to the house of Rothschild, which is the eighth beast, Mystery Babylon. And I clearly state that we are in the end times, but there still are yet prophecies to be fulfilled. So Revelation is not complete. And then my other document on that subject is Revelation Unfolded Part 1, which is an attempt to interpret the entire book of Revelation. And therein also I say that there still remain some prophecies yet to be fulfilled, especially the ones concerning the judgment day. Okay? So there's no way that I can be said to say that the revelation is complete and there's nothing left to be fulfilled. Okay? And I'm sure Bill, you pretty much agree with that position, don't you?
Well, I have an entire it's Bertrand Comparé's. It's not mine, but
okay.
Clifton quoted 30 or 40 pages of my own notes in with it, he included with it, and that's sitting on Clifton Emmerhire's website.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody wants to know my position on the Revelation, it hasn't changed since any of that was written.
Right, right.
We're in Revelation 17 right now.
Okay.
We're waiting for Babylon to fall,
17
and the kingdom, and the kingdom is handed over to the beast.
Yeah,
that's very, very clear. However, the book of Revelation is not one prophecy from the first chapter to the last. Some of the things in the later chapters have already been fulfilled.
Yes.
And one of them is Revelation chapter 20, where Satan is loosed and he's out deceiving the nations right now, and he has been since the Enlightenment.
And that's the House of Rothschild International Banking System.
The 1,000 years reign with Christ, that's not the first resurrection, because in Revelation chapter 25, where it says that the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years are completed, that's a lie, and it's a lie because it's not in any of the original manuscripts.
Okay.
All Revelations 25 says is that is, or this is the first restoration, period, end of story.
Uh-huh.
Go see the Christogenean New Testament.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, so neither you or I have an interpretation of Revelation which says it's all been done. And, of course, Keith's constantly accusing me of being a preterist, but a preterist is someone who teaches that all of Revelation was completed, all prophecy was completed in 70 AD. I've never taught any such thing ever, okay? So preterism, strictly defined, and that's of Catholic origin too. Some Catholic monk invented preterisms because the reformers were saying that the church is, or the pope is the Antichrist, okay?
Well, right, and one monk invented preterism and the other monk invented futurism. They rolled the dice on both interpretations and let them fall where they lay.
Right, right. So I'm what is called a historicist, and from reading your stuff, I'd say you are too, and historicism is simply an attempt to correlate biblical prophecy with historical events. Okay, whatever time frame or wherever they might occur in history. Okay, so we're not limited by 70 AD, and we're not limited by, most of the prophecies do end with the judgment day, okay, except for the fact that the wedding feast of the Lamb and, the kingdom in which we regain our immortal bodies, that comes obviously after the judgment day. Okay.
Well, Paul says to the Corinthians, I betrothed you in order to present you as a pure virgin to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now that word betrothed means engaged.
Okay.
Okay. It's not culminated yet until the second coming.
Right.
And
right.
if these clowns don't want to believe that there's a second coming, they better go read the scripture again.
Right. Yeah. I've never stated that the second coming has happened yet. On the contrary, I'm still waiting
for
that.
Well, guys like V.S. Herrill will deny that there's a literal second coming.
Okay.
But the gospel clearly says that Yahshua Christ will come down, will come again, just as you have seen him go up.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And
nobody's
I don't know how they
thing.
Could turn that into Titus in 70 A.D., which is what Herrill tries to do.
Right. Right. Yeah. So preterism, there's, you know, you look, there's virtually nothing, in my opinion, in the book of Revelation that conforms with preterism, because all of the post-Roman prophecies and even the ones that that are concerned the Roman Empire, the vast majority of them are after 70 A.D. There's only a few of them that occurred before 70 A.D. So, you know, there's no way that either one of us can be accused of preterism. In fact, those who preach, and this would include Harold, and I think also Keith Southworth as well, because he seems to think that the kingdom is already here. Okay? So he's the preterist. You know, he's saying it's already here. He constantly says that.
Yeah, well, I don't see it.
Yeah,
what I see is a bunch of Jew Rothschilds in
right. So I was
running
asking
everything.
If the kingdom's here, why is everybody fighting in wars? You know, isn't the kingdom supposed to put an end to all of that stuff?
Absolutely. The lion hasn't laid down with the lamb.
That's right. Okay, here we go. So just for the record, folks, we are not preterists, and we do not teach that the book of Revelation has been fulfilled in toto. Most of
No, the one guy on Rick Adams that accused you of being a preterist did so just on the basis of Revelation 25.
Right.
He doesn't realize that two-thirds of that verse doesn't belong in the scripture.
Right, it was invented by a Catholic priest, right?
It appears in a commentary version of the book of Revelation done by a medieval monk.
Okay. So it was not included in the Christian Bible until what, the 1400 AD?
It might be like a 9th century interpolation.
9th century, okay. Okay. All right. So let's continue now with Daniel chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, but the time appointed was long. In other words, the interpretation or the meaning of the vision was sometime in the future, and he understood the thing and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh nor wine in my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. And on the 4th and 20th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel, and then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body was also like the beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of the multitude. So obviously, he's having a vision of, you know, some sort of angelic being, certainly not a human being.
Well, right. This is very much like the visions that John saw in the Revelation.
That's exactly right.
And I like to say that river Hiddekel, that's mentioned. That's also that's the Tigris River, and that's mentioned in Revelation in Genesis 2:14.
Okay.
But yeah, this is very much like the visions John saw in the Revelation.
Yes. The parallels between Daniel and John in the way these visions are coming through them are very, very much identical. Okay, verse 7, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves, sort of like what Paul went through, right?
Right, sort of like Paul's road to Damascus event.
Yes. Verse 8, therefore I was left alone and saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. In other words, he felt weak and impure as a result of the great spectacle before him, the great being that he was beholding here. Verse 9, yet heard I the voice of his words, and when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep on my face, and my face toward the ground. And behold, a hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for to you am I now sent.
Now, and that also was just like the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where John said, you know, he saw this angel and fell on his face.
Right.
And the angel told him, yo, get up. You know,
right.
What are you doing?
Right. Well, in the case of Daniel, the angel is Gabriel, okay? But in the Revelation, it's Yahshua Messiah himself, okay? So that would be the only real difference here. At least that's what the books record, okay? And I stood trembling, verse 12. Then said he to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I am come for your words. Okay, so in other words, Daniel's prayers have been answered here, verse 13. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 120 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. So it sounds like there's some kind of war in heaven going on here.
Well, right, and this is what I'm going to get into, and I'm glad you mentioned that first, so that
okay.
I don't sound like I'm nuts. That's not.
Okay.
Well, first, the Septuagint has the end of this verse. It's not, and I remained there with the kings of Persia, because he wouldn't be here talking to Daniel.
Right.
It's, and I left him there with the chief of the kingdom of the Persians.
Okay.
And that's the Septuagint.
Okay.
And that makes much more sense in context.
Right.
Now I'm going to get enigmatic here, and so did you. But this is certainly seems to indicate that the course of nations is determined by forces more powerful than we can normally perceive.
Mm-hmm.
And especially we'll see it when we get to verse 20 below. Daniel is describing an angel in his vision, and that angel that Daniel's describing certainly seems to be. To be describing other angels or perhaps demons that actually rule over these nations, that actually, you know, in the unseen realm have an effect on the steering the course of these nations.
Yes, yes.
That there's no doubt. And I don't doubt for one bit that the non-white nations aren't guided by demon spirits. And I believe that the Kenite influences within our own white nations are also guided by demon spirits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's no doubt, and,
right.
And it's entirely scriptural.
Well, yeah, just to quickly address, you know, the no Satan issue, which actually is, I wouldn't say it's prevalent within Christian identity, but I know a few people who adhere to it, okay?
Oh, quite a few.
Yeah, and, you know, I would simply ask them, to whom was Yahshua Messiah talking when he cast the demons out of Legion, and they went into the herd of swine, and the herd of swine ran and drowned themselves in the lake? To whom was he speaking?
Well, Paul says that we fight against spiritual things of wickedness among the heavenly places.
That's
Ephesians
right.
Chapter 6.
That's right. There is a spiritual world, and there's a physical world, and those who would deny the spiritual world are denying half a reality, or if more than half a reality, really. Okay, because as Jesus also says, that whatever is done here on earth is also done in heaven. Okay, there's always a correlation, and we cannot, you know, obviously we live in the physical world, and we're only given glimpses of the spiritual world, and that's by design, because we have a function, we have a job to do here on this planet. We have physical enemies that we have to deal with, okay? And that's our primary function here. So, you know,
Well, didn't Paul say in one place that if the patriarchs had seen, you know, the spiritual side of things, that they wouldn't have wanted to deal with this world. They'd have wanted to go.
Right. Right.
It's in Hebrew somewhere. I forget exactly how he words it, but
yeah.
If they'd have seen, they're seeking the city of God, and if they'd have seen it, they wouldn't want to be here.
Well, I mean, you could say. Most of Christianity today is escapism, okay? It's escapism. It's a pretense that the world's problems don't exist, and therefore they want to forget the problems and their responsibilities.
Right, but
okay?
You're praying for your responsibility in the Our Father, in the prayer that we were taught to pray.
Don't remind them of that, Bill.
That
they don't want to
hear it. On earth as they are in heaven.
That's right, that's right.
And the only way that that's ever going to happen is that we finally decide to do the will of Yahweh.
Right, right. And this is what our people have been doing wrong throughout our entire history. We've been rebelling against the will of Yahweh because spiritism, seances, politics, and all these other things are more interesting, okay, than chasing the women of other races. These things are more interesting than what Yahweh wants us to do, okay? So, you know, and we're still in that state of rebellion, yeah, and modern Christianity reflects that state of rebellion, okay? Very good. Now, verse 14. Now I am come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days. Now, the latter days does not always mean the end times. What's your perspective on it? You know, sometimes
well, the Hebrew word akaris is also used in Genesis chapter 49, where Jacob, you know, blesses the 12 tribes, the 12 sons.
Mm-hmm.
And the word akaris in that context, when you read those blessings, it has to simply mean the future.
Yeah, okay.
That's all it means. This is and it means what will befall thy people in the future.
Yeah. Now the final clause here in verse 14 in the King James Version is for yet the vision is for many days, and that doesn't sound that's not a very good translation. This will take many days to happen, or is it many days in the future? What's the Septuagint say there?
Well, the Septuagint says, we're in verse 14.
14, yeah.
In those days, many shall resist the king. I'm in the wrong chapter.
Okay.
Sorry.
Chapter
you're in chapter 11.
Right.
Let me go to chapter 10.
Okay.
I had it set for chapter 11 for something.
Okay.
And came to make you understand what shall happen to your people in the days to come. Now, that's the New American Bible.
Okay.
For there is yet a vision concerning those days.
Okay.
Now, the Septuagint, and I
that's
have come
clear.
To inform thee of all that shall befall thy people in the last days. And I'm going to look at the Greek,
mm-hmm.
and that's, yeah, eschatos, the last of days. And that's a literal translation of akaris,
okay.
The Hebrew word.
Okay.
And the futurists take advantage of that word.
Mm-hmm.
And they push every prophecy.
Yeah.
That when you really read it, that pushes
right.
just about every prophecy to whenever.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and that absolves everybody of all responsibility for figuring out anything. Right.
Right. And it just occurred to me that what we were dealing with in Daniel chapter 9 was futurism, the attempt to put the Antichrist off into the future.
Well, right.
Yet
but
to
I mean
come, when in fact he's already here.
The language of Daniel clearly refutes that.
That's
because
right.
it's Yahshua Christ, not the Antichrist, that
yes.
took away the
sacrifices,
the oblations and the offerings.
That's right. Absolutely. Okay, verse 15. And when he had spoken such words to me, I set my face toward the ground, and I became dumb. And behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men. Okay, this was an angel, angelic being, looking like an Adamite. That's what this means, folks.
That same poetic description is used throughout Scripture.
Yes. Okay.
Especially in the Revelation also.
Yeah, okay. So it's not a space monkey. It's an angelic being that looked like a white man. That's what this is saying, folks. And behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? Now that's awkward. What do we have there in verse 17? For how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord?
How can my Lord's servant speak with you, my Lord?
Yeah, speak
now,
with you.
In other
okay.
words, he's calling himself his Lord's servant.
Right.
And that he's not worthy to speak with
yeah.
his angel.
Yeah, that's a really awkward sentence construction here by the KJV. Okay.
Well, that was, yeah, that the Shakespeare, proto-Shakespeare
right.
in English. You know?
That's right. Pseudo-Shakespeare.
Yeah.
For as for me, immediately there remained no strength in me, neither is there breath left in me. Then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me again. We're talking about, you know, another angelic being here looking like a white man. Verse 19. And said, O man greatly beloved, fear not, peace be to you, be strong, yea, be strong. And when he had spoken to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then said he, Know you wherefore I come to you, and now will I return to fight with the prince of Persia. Now, this prince of Persia, it must be a metaphor. Okay.
Well, you know, at the time, Cyrus is the king of Persia.
Yeah, because Cyrus was actually a very good king.
Cyrus himself was an excellent man and called a man of gold by Isaiah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so
you know, why would the angels fight with Cyrus?
Right,
Yahweh
yeah.
put Cyrus there for a reason.
Right, yeah.
But that doesn't mean that his successors, Cyrus's son Cambyses, for instance, who died returning from attempting to conquer Ethiopia.
Yes.
In Africa. He died on the way back. And
right.
he was a very cruel
right.
individual.
Right.
So even the best of us have crummy kids, right?
Yes, yes. So we can probably interpret this as being, you know, since heaven is timeless, only the physical universe is subject to time, as we know it anyway, that the Prince of Persia, this angelic being, would be referring to possibly one of the descendants of...
Well, you could say heaven is timeless in the manner that time needn't be kept, but there's still... measurable distances between events.
Right.
And I'd like to say that, you know, he says he's going to fight with the prince of Persia, and when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come.
Yes.
And that may, you know, if the prince of Persia is in the spiritual realm here, so is the prince of Grecia.
Right.
And I think that what this signifies is that before a great nation is defeated, there has to be a spiritual defeat also.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
That something
exactly.
else has
yeah,
to
so,
break down.
So this is an example of the war in heaven, okay, that we are told about in the New Testament.
And being played out here on earth.
Yes, exactly. Okay, verse 21. But I will show you that which is noted in the scripture of truth, and there is none that holds with me in these things but Michael, your prince. Okay, so again, I'm assuming that the speaker here is Gabriel. And he is speaking of Michael. Okay, any comments on chapter 10?
Well, some commentators, and I think it might be in chapter 12 when we get to Daniel, that Michael is just another title for Yahshua himself.
Okay.
And that's if that's so, then what this angel is saying is that only Yahshua himself really knows the...
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Really knows of what's being revealed to Daniel.
Right.
In other words, he got this directly from him, and you could look at it both ways. I don't care which interpretation is legitimate. It's not important to me because it's all holy. It's all
well. The important thing is the vision and the fulfillment of the vision, not necessarily who uttered it. Okay. So even if the Book of Revelation weren't dictated by Yahshua himself, if it was dictated by some other entity, the fact is that. That's damn good prophecy, you know. It's all worth
right. Once somebody's heart is open to see it,
yes,
and to see it correctly and understands the history,
mm-hmm.
and you have to study the history and understand the history in order to see it. That's
yeah, no, it's a thought occurs to me as we're talking about this. What if Mein Kampf, or if you issued Mein Kampf by some other title, and just you know, issued it as if it weren't even written by Hitler, gave it a new title and a new pseudonym for an author, and just issued it as a completely different book. I wonder how many people would take it more seriously.
well, yeah. I mean, we could take out the references to Austria.
Yeah.
Or you know, better yet, we could take the references to Austria and just use a word processor and change them all to New York City or something.
Yeah, right.
And it would and take out the references in to World War One and
right.
change it to Vietnam.
Right, right.
And it would pretty much, you wouldn't have to change too much else to make it a convincing book about America
right.
in the 70s, 80s,
that's
and
90s. That's right. Just change Munich to New York City and you got it down. Just like we've often said that America is going through the exact same processes as ancient Judea did when the Edomites took over.
You could change the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns to the Democrats and the Republicans.
There you go. That's right. That's absolutely right. History is repeating itself, you know. And so, as Commander Bragg,
history repeats itself for one reason. There's only one reason why history repeats itself.
because we're stupid.
Don't learn from it.
Right. And we're bound and determined not to learn from it.
Right.
In fact,
we deny it.
Yeah, exactly. We deny that it's happening. No, Obama's a good president. I predicted, folks, that Obama would just be a black version of George Bush.
Yeah, well, he's it's one set of Jews sitting in a think tank for 4 years while the other set of Jews sits in a White House, and then every couple of elections or so they change sides, they change seats.
And they're both the spitting image. Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama are the spitting image of that Mad Magazine cover boy. I forget what his name is.
Yeah, they both fit him in different peculiar ways, don't they?
They look like his twin brothers.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's incredible.
Yeah, all right. Okay. I think Yahweh's just having fun with us here, you know. Anyway, let's go into Daniel chapter 11, which is one of these historicist chapters, as I like to say, because historicism is the comparison of prophecy with historical events, okay, no matter whether they occurred before 70 A.D. or after 70 A.D., okay? All right, so here we go. Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. Do you have an idea what time period we're talking here, the first year of Darius the Mede?
Well, okay, first, let me say that there seems to be a problem here with the text of Daniel.
Okay.
The Septuagint has the first year of Cyrus.
Oh, okay.
At the beginning of chapter 11.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
oh, wow, that's
but
different.
The Septuagint agrees with the King James here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dead Sea Scrolls agree with the King James.
Okay.
Here and at chapter 11.
Okay.
So it's not
chapter 10 and 11? Because here it says...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because chapter 10 says in the third year of Cyrus.
Yeah, I'm thinking about chapter 10 in the third year of Cyrus, right?
And chapter 11 says in the first year of Darius.
That's what I was going to point out next.
Yeah, right.
Now, this Darius the Mede, if this isn't an error for Cyrus, and if it's an error for Cyrus, then 10 and 11, the two chapters, are in the wrong order. Which is possible, okay? It's not... I read the text. I tried to make it make sense. It's not impossible. However, I would settle on the order that they're in now. And this Darius the Mede, as we have seen him mentioned earlier in Daniel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It can be shown that this Darius the Mede from Daniel 9, that this Darius is the son of the emperor and a satrap over Babylon.
Oh, okay.
If you read Daniel 9, you'll see that that's very clear.
Okay.
That he is a satrap over Babylon,
uh-huh,
and not the emperor.
Okay.
Now, Darius, there's a historical emperor of Persia that the Greeks call Darius.
Okay.
Okay, who we're going to be discussing in another verse or two here.
Okay.
But Darius is only, it appears often in the histories and in the scriptures, and it's used as a title.
Uh-huh.
It's consistently used as just a title.
Right.
It's not a given name.
Mm-hmm.
And Ahasuerus is a title.
Yes.
It means a governor.
Okay.
And Darius is a title.
Okay. So
Ahasuerus was translated by the Greek, transliterated by the Greeks into Artaxerxes.
Right.
And stuck on a couple of the Persian emperors.
Right,
as
right.
The Greeks wrote their history.
So it's actually a title which has been assumed by many historians to be a name when it really
Well, it has been assumed by many historians to be a name, yes.
Yes. Okay.
But if you look at the usage of the word Darius,
yes,
it's clearly a title.
Okay.
Probably a title of reverence or respect.
Yes.
Like Augustus had become a title of reverence and respect among the Roman emperors.
Yes.
And even in the book of Acts, Nero is called Augustus.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't point that out when we covered Acts because I didn't
Yeah.
You know, we were too busy discussing other things.
Right.
But
right.
Nero is called Augustus in the Book of Acts.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
And it's Nero. It's, you know, it's not Octavian.
Right, 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 yeah.
Who was the first Augustus.
Yeah, so you have to be aware of these title/name, you know, transpositions.
Well, right, because people who haven't really read the histories.
Yes.
Can get very easily confused with them.
Yes, yeah, because...
And be led to all sorts of wrong conclusions.
Right, right. So you really have to pay attention to the historical period to get these things right. Okay, very good. Okay.
Now, no matter what this is supposed to say,
uh-huh.
The current Persian emperor is clearly Cyrus.
Cyrus, okay. Very
okay.
good. Very good. Okay, verse 2. And now will I show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet 3 kings in Persia... And the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. Okay? So we're talking about the kings of Persia, and there shall yet be 3 more after Darius. Is that what we're supposed
to? Well, 3 more after Cyrus.
After Cyrus,
yeah,
right.
You know,
right.
After the current one,
mm-hmm.
Who's clearly Cyrus, and that's proven out. Because Cyrus ruled for over 20 years.
Okay.
And you know, we're only in his third year in Daniel chapter 10.
Uh-huh. Okay. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the 4 winds of heaven.
Now let's discuss this prophecy before we get too far ahead.
Okay.
And Cyrus is the current king. And Daniel says that there'll be 3 kings and then a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And that fourth will go up against the whole realm of the Greeks.
Right.
Okay. Well, from Cyrus, there was Cambyses, who ruled until 522 BC.
Mm-hmm.
There was Smerdis the Magi, who was a usurper.
Okay.
Okay. And some historians say he wasn't the usurper. That Darius only said he was a usurper. But either way, he only ruled for 9 months.
Okay.
And got overthrown by Darius Hystaspes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have Cambyses, Smerdis, the Greeks called him. His real name was Guamata the Magi.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather call him Smerdis, too.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
And then Darius Hystaspes, who ruled actually for a long time from 521 to 46 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And his son was Xerxes.
Okay.
Okay, and Darius started this war against the Greeks.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay, by going to war against the Scythians and trying to gain control of all the land around the Black Sea.
Yes.
So that he could get Greece and from the north and from the east at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have them boxed in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here, I'd like to, if you have some more to say about that, please continue.
Well, yeah, I'll be quick.
And no, Darius, you have to be quick. I just want to let you know I'm going to be quoting from Howard B. Rand on this same issue.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, Darius reigned until 486 B.C. But
okay.
In 490 B.C., the Greeks, 8,000 Greeks, slaughtered 40,000 Persians in the Battle of Marathon.
Uh-huh.
So Darius began building up for this great war against the Greeks and didn't live long enough to finish it.
Uh-huh.
His son Xerxes took over.
Right.
His son Xerxes took the throne in 486 and actually set out to invade Greece about 480, 479 and lost his major battles in 478
okay. BC. Yeah.
Which were the Battle of Salamis, the Battle of Plataea, and the Battle of Mycenae, I believe.
Okay, okay. So the Greeks kicked butt against the Persians. in those days, okay? Well, here is how Howard B. Rand interprets these things, and it's virtually identical with what you just said here in his book, Study in Daniel. The only differences would be that, you know, the lengths of these reigns are somewhat different, okay? That's about it, okay? A wise king, this is page 271, referring to Daniel 11, 2 through the verses we're discussing right now, 2 through 5. Cyrus reigned after the death of his uncle Darius, and it was he who issued the edict permitting the Judahites, who had been in captivity just 70 years, to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and the city.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, we have already dealt with the chronological significance of the year in which this edict was issued, and he probably agrees that we were talking about chapter 9, that decree. That,
70 years that Jerusalem was to be left desolate.
Right, right. So according to this history, Cyrus reigned 7 years after the death of Darius. Now we're talking about the original Darius who overthrew Babylon. Okay.
Well, actually, Cyrus overthrew Babylon.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know who he's counting as Darius before Cyrus.
Okay. Yeah.
Because
well,
before Cyrus, all right, Cyrus is the son of a woman who was a Median princess.
Mm-hmm.
And his father was a Persian nobleman. However, they were not on the throne.
Okay.
Okay. The Medes were ruling over the Persians.
Ah, okay.
And the king of the Medes was Astyages. Astyages, it's usually spelled.
Okay.
In English.
Astyages. Okay.
Now Astyages gives birth to this Median, you know, his daughter gives birth to this this baby by this Persian, and Astyages wants to kill the child.
Okay.
That's the story from Herodotus, anyway.
Okay.
That he commands that it be exposed.
Right.
And the child's hidden away, and it grows up, and eventually becomes the leader of the Persians and overthrows the Medes.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
So that the two nations stay joined at the hip, but now the Persians are the leading nation.
Right.
From that time
right.
on.
Okay, so... The twins take turns.
Right. And he gets control of Persia and Media by 550 BC.
Okay.
And he reigns, he comes into Babylon in 539 BC.
Okay.
He reigns until 529 BC.
Yeah.
BC.
Yeah, but because the book of Daniel says that Darius was the one who took Babylon. Okay.
Well, right, but that's being used as a title for Cyrus.
Oh, okay. All right.
And Rand is just confused.
Okay, and so Rand is he's taking these names as literal names, and he's not dealing with the title issue.
Right,
okay.
And it's definitely Cyrus that takes Babylon, and if you remember, we spoke about the prophecy of the opening of the two-leaved gates and how Babylon's walls were never breached because Cyrus diverted the river.
Right.
And Herodotus and all, you know, Xenophon, Herodotus, Thucydides, they all tell pieces of that story, and Herodotus and Xenophon both tell it at length.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, how Cyrus, this very Cyrus, took Babylon.
Okay. Well, then he says on page 272, just before Cyrus' death, he appointed Cambyses, one of his sons, as his successor, while to his younger son, Smerdis, he gave control over several provincial governments. Advising his sons, he said this, quote, the strength and support of the throne was neither the vast extent of countries, nor the number of forces, nor immense riches, but a due respect for the deity, a good understanding between brethren, and the art of acquiring and preserving true and faithful friends. Okay, so Cyrus was a good man, no doubt about
it. Well, Cyrus was a good man, but I don't know where Rand gets this account from.
He doesn't cite his source. But that he's quoting some source here. He doesn't cite the source. Okay.
It doesn't come from the early Greek source. I don't know if it comes from anything.
Maybe he's quoting some stele or something. You know, some.
That's very possible. I'm not doubting it. I just don't.
Yeah, I wish he would cite it here. It'd be very good to check up on that. Okay. All right. So, and then he concludes with the death of Cyrus, a good and benevolent king passed away. You know, therefore, also verifying that. When the angel in verse 10:20, talking about making war with the prince of Persia, it's not referring to Cyrus. It's referring to his successors, really. But that was still to come. Okay, a cruel king, Cambyses, Cyrus' son, came to the throne in his place. Egypt revolted, and he advanced against the land and conquered it. But he was an arrogant, cruel, and evil king in every way. He refused to take the advice of his father, and in drunkenness and fits of anger carried on a tyrannical rule. This unprincipled king reigned for 7 years, and then he died. I believe you said he reigned 20 years, or if I remember.
Well, no, I said I told you that Cambyses was a cruel king and died coming back from Ethiopia in battle.
Okay.
Cyrus reigned for 21 years.
Cyrus reigned 20. Okay. Following
Cambyses only reigned from 529 to 522 BC.
Okay, so 7 years. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, following a short period of trouble, when others tried to usurp authority and rule in Persia, Darius Hystaspes came to the throne. It was during his reign that the decree was issued to continue the work of rebuilding the temple. That work had ceased as a result of the opposition on the part of the enemies of Judah and Benjamin. Now, of course, that wasn't the decree that started the 70 weeks. That was one of the several previous decrees. I think we talked about that at length, okay? So, and then he says, Darius made a foolish expedition against the Scythians in the north, and as a result, we have the famous message recorded in history, which was sent to him by the Scythian leader. The message was in the form of a present of a bird, a mouse, a frog, and five arrows, the meaning of which was this, quote, "By these you are to know that unless you can fly away in the air like birds, or hide yourselves in the earth like mice, or swim in the water like frogs, you shall in no wise be able to avoid the arrows of the Scythians."
Right. And there's, you know, Rand is using all Greek names and Greek titles, so he's definitely getting all this from Greek sources.
Okay, yeah, but he's not citing what they are. Okay.
Right, but, you know, this story is a popular one, too,
mm-hmm.
and amongst the Greek writers. It's retold, I think, by Strabo or Diodorus and a few other writers I've read. But, you know, calling Smyrtus, and his Persian name is Bardiya, B-A-R-D-I-Y-A.
Okay.
So, you know, if he's using all Greek terms, he's probably quoting Greek sources.
Yes. Okay. All right. And then continuing here, because he does get to Xerxes, Scythians or Israelites. The Scythians were Israelites of the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel, who had, many years before, left the land of their captors, Assyria. As the Scythians, they were residing north and west of the Babylonian and Persian empires. Darius' campaign against them caused him to suffer much and accomplish nothing. The famous Battle of Marathon was fought during his reign, and Darius suffered defeat in Greece. He also had a rebellion on his hands in Egypt. He planned to move against both countries, but died after reigning 36 years and before he could carry out his plans. He was succeeded by Xerxes the Great. Xerxes the Great was the fourth king to whom the angel had referred, who was exceedingly wealthy. With his riches, he equipped a great army to wage war against Greece, hiring assistance from Carthage, Spain, Gallia, now France, as well as from Italy. Though he assembled a powerful army and a great navy against Greece, he was finally defeated and retired to Persia.
Xerxes had great control over all those nations in the Mediterranean, because all of those nations in the Mediterranean were settled by the Phoenicians, who still had an allegiance to Tyre.
Oh, okay.
And Tyre was controlled by the Persians.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So that, through Tyre, that extended the Persian realm to all of Tyre's colonies that still felt an allegiance to the mother city.
Well,
Now, Carthage, and this can be proven out in history, because when Xerxes crosses into Greece on land to invade Greece, there were more Greeks in what's called Magna Graecia, which is the boot of Italy and Sicily at the time.
Okay.
There were more Greeks there than there are in Greece.
Okay.
Okay? And they could not come to the aid of the Greeks in Greece, which they surely would have, because at the same time Xerxes invades Greece, the Carthaginians invaded Sicily. And those events have to be connected.
Right.
And some historians don't make the connection.
Yeah. So they were actually, the Carthaginians were mercenaries on behalf of the Persians.
Absolutely.
Invading Greece.
And they pulled soldiers and sailors from Iberia and from Gaul, where there were Phoenicians dwelling in diverse places.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some paying mercenaries, you know, from other nations also, like the Celts.
Yes. And in many cases, you either fight with our side or we kill you now. That was the way things were. In fact, that's how things were in World War II as well. Because I know many people of different nations, such as Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, they had most of them were anti-communists, but yet Stalin conscripted them at on pain of death.
Well, right, but in the ancient world, it really wasn't like that.
Okay.
In the ancient world, life was harsh, and men were austere.
Yeah.
And men looked for a reason to go to war and try to get some booty.
Right.
That was an opportunity.
Right.
It wasn't always something to be shunned. I mean, it's the farm or the booty.
Right.
And the prospect of booty and adventure was quite often in a young man's mind.
Yeah.
But much better than staying on the farm.
Yeah, or chopping down trees and stuff, right? Yes, okay. Yeah. Okay, very good. Where do we leave off here?
We should start back with verse 3, probably.
Verse 3, okay. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. So here we're pretty much set that that's Xerxes.
Well, this is, Xerxes is already pretty much, ends when it says, through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia.
Okay.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Now the mighty king that stands up is Alexander the Great.
Okay.
Because if you read verse 4, you'll see that.
Oh, right. Okay. So the verse 2 is talking about the fourth. That's right. Verse 3 is not talking
about
the fourth.
And this is like the fourth time maybe that Daniel talks about these kings.
Mm-hmm.
In Daniel chapter 2, they're in Daniel chapter 7. Then there's the vision of the ram and the goat in Daniel chapter 8. And now again in Daniel chapter 11.
Right. Okay, yeah. So verse 2 has to do with the fourth king, but verse 3 has to do with the king of Grecia. Okay, right. Verse 3, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. That's Alexander. Okay. And verse 4, and when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. Okay, of course, four winds of heaven can be reinterpreted as his four generals.
Cassander and Antigonus and Ptolemy and
Lysimachus. Right. Okay. And toward the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. Okay. So, yes, his direct family did not inherit the kingdom. It was divided among the four generals. Okay. Nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. Okay. So, in other words, verse 4 is telling us that Alexander's direct descendants would not inherit his kingdom. Okay.
Well, his direct descendants did not, right?
Yes.
And that's what he's saying. His posterity won't get it. And actually, he had a son, and he had a son back in Macedonia who was a very young boy when he died. And the deal with the four generals was that Cassander, who got, Alexander's homeland, Macedonia, he would keep that kingdom for Alexander's son.
Okay.
And by some chance mishap, Alexander's son was died long before he became of age.
Right. Right.
It's almost a certainty that Cassander or his successors bumped the boy off.
And another Shakespearean event.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the curse against the house of David anyway.
Yes.
That's the curse against our kings anyway, because David, it's given in Samuel when David takes Bathsheba.
Yeah.
The sword will always be against his house.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that's been the history of our kings and queens. There's no doubt about it. Okay. Now, verse 5, and then we change the subject again. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion, okay? Now, Rand, I won't quote it just yet, but Rand interprets the king of the south as the Ptolemies.
Okay. All right, yes, that's true.
Okay.
And I have Fowler here also.
Okay.
And Fowler says that verses, from here through verse 30, is talking about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
Okay.
Okay, now I don't necessarily agree with that.
Okay.
Oh, okay, and he doesn't give specific instances of how any of it was fulfilled, except to say that the And talk about the vile person in verse 21 being Antiochus Epiphanes.
Okay.
And I'll discuss more of it as we read on.
Yeah.
But it's very vague, a lot of it. And let me say that I have a study Bible from that Liberty University in Texas.
Okay.
And they get to the third verse and interpret the first three verses here. They interpret 5, 6, and 7. And after that, they say, and this has all been fulfilled.
Okay.
And they don't interpret another thing for the rest of the chapter.
It's all been fulfilled, but we have no idea what it means.
They just want you to take it for granted,
yes.
and to believe them because they told you so.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's precious. That's precious, right. And it's, what do you call that, authority. You, we're the authorities. You believe what we say.
Right.
You accept what we say without question. Well, here, let me quote what Rand has to say. King of the South. Alexander the Great became king of Greece and did just as he pleased while he ruled. He died soon after he had completed his conquest, and his kingdom was divided among four of his generals. His own immediate family perished in their endeavor to take over the throne. Strong shall the king of the south be, but one of his captains shall be stronger still. That's in verse 5, which, yes, okay, so that's, who's he? Oh, that's the Moffat translation, okay. And verse 5 in King James is rather cumbersome. Let me quote 5 again. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. The Moffat translation is much clearer. Strong shall be the king of the south, but one of his captains shall be stronger still.
And that's the sense of it is correct there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Septuagint, the Greek is even more horrible than the King James.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the word dunastase appears twice,
uh-huh,
as a noun, and the verbal equivalent appears twice.
Okay.
And it's just like, it drives me crazy when,
yeah,
I try to read it.
Okay. Okay.
It's very cumbersome.
Yeah.
Now let me say this.
Okay.
The Ptolemies never extended or strengthened the boundaries of Alexander's empire or their portion of it.
Okay.
Really, I mean, he made some war in the Greek islands.
Right.
And there were wars all throughout Greece under Alexander's successors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
The Macedonians were always fighting with the Seleucids, who were always fighting with the Ptolemies.
Right.
It was a four-way battle that became a three-way battle.
Yes.
And it just never ended.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
it was ended by Rome.
Basically, yes,
yeah.
It was ended by Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were always fighting.
Yeah,
The Spartans were always rising up and throwing off the yoke of Alexander's successors and trying to go, you know, recapture the glory of old Sparta.
Okay.
And there was an Achaean League which covers most of what we know as southern, you know, Greece proper. And they were always trying to rise up against them. And,
yeah,
and there were wars, war after war after war. The social wars, the Macedonian wars. And they were series,
mm-hmm,
of endless 30-year wars. That,
yes.
I mean, Greece was really devouring herself from the inside out.
Yeah.
For centuries, yeah, and centuries.
Yeah, civil war, but in other lands. Fascinating. Fascinating. But let's see. Number 7, I think you briefly addressed this earlier. Daniel 10:13, is Michael also Yahweh Yahshua? Some say yes, and Yahshua also was Melchizedek.
I don't believe that, and we spoke about this when we did the two seed line series, that,
right,
Melchizedek is Yahshua.
Okay.
Yahshua has no body until he's born in the flesh.
Right. Right, and Melchizedek, the priest.
And it's even in the scripture that he's a spirit until he was born in the flesh.
Right, and so the Melchizedek was a direct descendant of Adam, the high priest.
Yes.
Directly to whoever it was at the time.
And Paul uses him as a type for Yahshua.
Okay.
Because he's of unrecorded parentage, which,
right,
is what Paul says in Hebrews.
Yes. And you stated earlier, I think before Les tuned in, that you think Michael and Yahshua are the same.
Well, exactly. And Clifton does too. And it's not necessary to me whether or not they're the same.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be,
yeah,
that Daniel 12, if Daniel 12 is an end time prophecy,
mm-hmm,
Michael will stand for, you know, for his people.
Yeah.
And that seems to be an epithet for Yahshua himself.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, that's just what it seems to be.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of people who believe that way. You know, I haven't made up my mind.
Right. I'm not saying it's written in stone, but it seems to be plausible.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and I can go with the maybe. I don't have to make my mind up. I don't pick these interpretations of Scripture like people pick football teams.
Yeah.
And too many people pick interpretations
of
Scripture.
Hey, let's have a lottery.
Like football.
Let's
right.
have a lottery.
One
though.
Has to be right,
yeah.
And one has to be wrong. And if yours
yeah.
is wrong, you're not inspired by
yeah.
God.
Yeah, right.
So you're a false prophet.
Right. Right.
You know, I'm not going to pretend to be a prophet in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
I studied the Bible and history and Greek. That, you know, that's enough for me.
Yeah, we're doing our best. You know, as I said, we're basically historicists, and we're trying to compare, you know, these prophecies with historical events. Okay, no matter.
Right,
you know,
and that's all that matters is the proof of the
right.
prophecy.
Yeah.
It is the reason why we should be faithful to Christ.
Right, right, and whether or not Michael is in fact Yahshua. Yahweh won't hold it against us if we believe it or don't believe it. You know, it's not a matter of law, okay? And it's really not a point of prophecy, you know. So, but if he is, fine. Okay.
Well, exactly. But there's a whole lot of clowns out there that make big things out of little things.
Right. Okay.
It says, at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a reference to...
Yahshua.
To an angel, it could be a reference to a man,
mm-hmm.
a great human ruler. We don't know until it's fulfilled. We won't know until that time comes.
Right.
But as far as I'm concerned, it seems to point to Yahshua because all the other prophecies, only Yahshua Christ could get us out of this mess with it that we're
That's
in.
That's right. Well, we know it won't be Arthur Kemp.
It absolutely won't be. Arthur Kemp is going to hell.
Yeah, that's right.
Right
even
where
though,
he belongs.
Even though he's a white racist, right? Or appears to be, anyway.
Him and his lying book.
Yeah, right. Okay, so continuing here with Rand. Here, for the first time, we are introduced to a king of the South. The Grecian Empire had been divided into four parts, and the ruler of Egypt, the southern division of the Grecian Empire, was called the King of the South. The first King of the South was Ptolemy Soter, one of Alexander's generals. He controlled Libya, Egypt, Cyrenaica, Arabia, Palestine, and several islands in the Aegean Sea. Okay, and so there's another prophecy about the King of the South controlling islands. Okay, so let me continue here before we get to the King of the North. And verse 6, and in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that fathered her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Okay, this is very vague, right?
Well, yeah, it's very vague. Let me say that this seems to be describing the Ptolemies, Ptolemy Soter,
right.
Ptolemy Lagi, Ptolemy Philadelphus, Ptolemy Eucertus. Some of the Ptolemies did control some of the islands of the sea at
mm-hmm.
some of the times.
Okay.
In other words, none of them held on to them for long because
right.
they were always fighting with each other and taking them off each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, that goes for Crete, Cyprus, that goes for all of them.
Right.
Now, this agreement with this female character here
okay.
seems to be describing the marriage between Cleopatra, the daughter of Ptolemy Eucertes,
yes. mm-hmm.
and Antiochus the Great, the grandson of Seleucus.
Okay.
And it's mentioned in Josephus Antiquities chapter 12.
Okay.
Or book 12. But
yeah.
but I don't know if this is really describing that.
Well, that's the first thing that occurred to me was Cleopatra. However, there was a character by the name of Bernice. Here's what Rand has to say about it. War between the North and South. After a few years, Antiochus Theos came to the throne in Syria in the North. In Egypt, Ptolemy Philadelphus became king. Antiochus made war against Ptolemy, but due to an insurrection in the eastern part of the Antiochus dominion, it became necessary for him to stop the conflict with Ptolemy. Ptolemy took advantage of the situation and compelled Antiochus to divorce his wife, Laodice, that's L-A-D-O-I-C-E, Laodice, disinherit her two sons and take Queen Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy, as his wife. Okay, this sounds like verse 6. Okay, it was Ptolemy's purpose to thus give the crown of Syria to the royal house of Egypt, and he specified that Bernice's children should be heirs to the Syrian throne. Antiochus, the king of Syria, or the north, made the agreement. He divorced Laodice, disinherited her children, and Bernice became his wife. It proved to be of no help to him. For Ptolemy died, and Antiochus put Bernice and her son away and recalled Laodice. Okay? So this sounds like verse 6.
Well, right. And that's if you want to interpret this in the worldly manner that
right. It's
usually interpreted in.
Okay.
However, we see the kings and the princes of Daniel chapter 10 are not earthly kings and princes.
Right, yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, but we can certainly say that there's a war in heaven simultaneously with the war on earth.
And I would interpret this to mean that the general cultural, economic, religious forces that control the South, Arabia, Egypt, and the general cultural, economic, religious forces that control the North,
uh-huh.
and the demons, princes, or angels behind those forces.
Yes.
Okay,
yes. Oh, yes.
And that's how I would read this King of the North and King of the South.
Okay.
And that at various points in history, this struggle manifested itself under various names.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Like the satanic Jews 2,000 years ago manifested themselves as Esau.
Right.
Today, they're Khazars or whatever you want to call them.
Right. Ashkenazi.
Okay?
Yeah.
That they it's the same
reptilian
satanic force under right. a different name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the King of the North and the King of the South here at the very beginning might be, you know, those economic and religious interests.
Yes.
And those spiritual interests might be represented as
right.
Ptolemy and Antiochus for a short period of time.
Right, right.
However, there is a greater, there's a much greater narrative that seems to come into play with through many of these statements.
Right, right.
And I think that as we proceed into Daniel chapter 11, we'll clear, to me, it's clear that this is the struggle between imperial Romish Catholicism,
okay,
or popism, papaism, or whatever you want
right.
to call it,
popery,
or
yeah.
Poopery,
yeah, right.
and Islam.
Uh-huh, okay.
Okay.
Well, I certainly am a proponent of dual interpretations, you know, that there's an original fulfillment and then the future, usually on a larger scale fulfillment, okay? And I think, you know, most interpreters call it type and anti-type, but, you know, I refer to it as fulfillment and dual fulfillment.
Well, I understand that, and I understand the concept, and I don't argue with it because I'm not sure if it's – or for it because I'm
right.
not sure if it's right or wrong.
Right.
But there seems to be a much greater range of things coming into play here than simply the struggle between Ptolemy and Seleucus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And when we get up to, say, verse 31 here, and arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is talking about something in Daniel's future that 580 years later, after Daniel wrote this,
mm-hmm.
it's still in Yahshua's future.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So if this whole chapter is about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, then in verse 31 it skips how many hundreds of years?
Right, right. Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Sure, sure.
That this is it starts out with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids,
okay.
but it transcends that.
Okay.
And well, there's no, you know, it talks about a dominion in verse 5 here. And the king of the south shall be strong,
mm-hmm.
and one of his princes, he shall be strong above him, and his dominion shall be a great dominion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't really describe any of the Ptolemies. I'm sorry.
Okay.
none of them real. I mean, a couple of islands in the Mediterranean they fought over a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaza that they fought over with the Seleucids over Gaza a few times.
Right.
Even the addition of those does not meet this description.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it became Ptolemaic Egypt, and I guess Cleopatra is the most famous Ptolemaic ruler.
Well, right, and she invaded the north once.
Yes.
At the Battle of Actium, and they got their butts kicked.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's about it. And that doesn't meet this description.
You're saying that Cleopatra wasn't great?
She was a whore.
A great
whore,
right.
She was a great whore. She was probably the image on the mind of Yahshua Christ when he described the great whore to John. I'm sure.
Right. But, you know, I'm certainly a proponent of the dual interpretations, and Howard B. Rand is doing his best here to correlate these prophecies with Ptolemaic Egypt and, of course, all the four generals that split up Alexander's empire, okay? And then, of course, I think we can broaden this discussion.
Well, that certainly fits hand in glove,
mm-hmm.
but we have to take it beyond just two of those generals.
Right.
Because, obviously, the scope in the middle and end of the chapter far transcends.
Okay.
The Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
Right, right.
And I would think that, and I'm going to turn to Islam again, but only because of it's had a 2,000-year impact on Christendom.
Yes.
And Muhammad fits verse 5 a hell of a lot better.
Okay.
You know where it talks about the extent of the increase in his dominion,
mm-hmm.
and that his successors took it far beyond what he did.
Right, right. And his,
all the way to hell of Malaysia.
Right, and his his source of origin would have been right across the Red Sea from the Ptolemies. Right? So it would have been
part of the Ptolemaic kingdom, absolutely.
Right.
It was part of the lands ruled by the Ptolemies.
Okay, so I mean there's definitely a connection here, and you know there's many statements in the Bible that are actually literally true that have prophetic meaning and more than one fulfillment. Okay, so certainly this could be just another case of that. Yes. Okay, but here let me read verse 7 now and give you Howard Rand's.
Where it says in the end of years they shall join themselves together.
Okay,
that doesn't really fit this Cleopatra either. But, you know, Islam and Judaism, they've really gotten along just fine for many, many
years. Yeah, they claim to be enemies, don't they?
Yeah, but, I mean, the Jews and the Muslims got along just fine under the Khazar trading empire.
That's right.
From 600 to 900 A.D., they were joined at the hip. And the Jews brought the Muslim Moors into Spain, and the Moors were glad enough, happy enough to do the bidding of the Jews in Spain.
Right, right. And the Jews threw the gates open of the Christian cities to allow the Moors in.
Now, Muhammad, it can be demonstrated, and I think Clifton and I will talk about this tomorrow night, too, and I think Clifton, he has some pretty good citations for this. Muhammad had a Jewish mother, and he had all Jewish wives.
All right.
And it says in the end of years
like
they
Stalin.
Shall join themselves together.
Just like Stalin. He had three Jewish wives. And he was Jewish himself. His Georgian name was actually Djugashvili, which means Jewison. A lot of people don't know that Stalin was actually Jewish.
Yeah, his original last name proves that he's a Jew.
That's right.
And I've heard that right from sincere Russian people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so we have many fulfillments. I mean, this type of history repeats itself. It really does. It's amazing. It's amazing. So please go on. You were talking about...
Well, you can go to verse 7.
Go to verse 7? Okay. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Let me read verse 8, rather, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their goods, or their gods, rather, with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So
now, by no means can I see this fulfillment with the Ptolemies.
Okay, well, here is what did I lose the place here?
Rand, I hope you found it.
Here it is. Okay, invasion of the north. Here it is.
I can't find an event that matches with this well.
Here it is. Laodice poisoned her husband Antiochus and placed her son Seleucus Callinicus on the throne. Berenice and her son with an Egyptian guard were returning to Egypt, but Laodice and her son pursued Berenice, killing her son, and the Egyptian guard. All were given up to death as prophesied. Quote, now he's using the Moffat translation of Daniel 11:7-8, okay, which I just quoted here from the King James. But then shall arise a scion of her own family in succession to his father, who shall head an army to enter the fortress of the king of the north. He shall take action and master the men of the north, carrying off their gods, metal images, and rare vessels of silver and gold to Egypt. Ptolemy Evergetes, Evergetes.
Right, it's his daughter that married Antiochus.
Okay. A brother of Berenice succeeded his father and came to the throne in Egypt. Learning of the cruel death of his sister and son, Ptolemy attacked the king of the north, for Seleucus was then on the throne of Syria. He did prevail, as prophecy declared he would, and carried away to Egypt their princes, gods, and vessels of silver and gold. The King James Version states, as I just quoted, I'll quote it here from his book, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land, okay?
And what year did this supposed to happen in?
What year?
Yes.
He doesn't
state?
He doesn't give dates for these things. So, but this should be, you know, pretty easily verifiable as to when these things occurred.
Well, I noted, all right, Ptolemy III Euergetes supported his sister Berenice II in the Third Syrian War and acquired the coast of Syria and southern Asia Minor, as well as some Asian ports.
Mm-hmm.
But he lost the Cyclades to Antigonus through the Battle of Andros in 246.
Okay.
That was the height of the Ptolemaic power, and none of those gains were enduring.
Okay, right. And all it really says here is that he had a military victory over the king of the north and carried off a lot of junk.
Well, right, but this says he shall continue more years than the king of the north.
Well, probably just meaning that his reign would last longer than the king of the north, okay? That probably doesn't mean much more than that. Well, let me read verse 9 here from the King James. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return, be stirred up even to his fortress. So here is how Rand interprets this. Ptolemy continued longer on the throne of Egypt than Seleucus did on the throne of Syria. Also, Ptolemy outlived Seleucus. The king of the north shall then invade the realm of the king of the south. His son shall then make war, gathering a vast army for the attack, and one of them shall surge forward to the south, pushing the attack as far as the fortress of Gaza. Moffat translation, Daniel 11:9-10. Seleucus Callinicus' sons, Leleucus Serranus and Antiochus the Great, raised a large army. And Antiochus the Great, at the head of the army, moved against the king of the south, but because of trouble at home and within his own government, he returned. In a fit of mad rage, the king of the south shall march out to fight the king of the north, who shall raise a large army. Again, this is a Moffat translation of Daniel 11-13. But it shall fall into the hands of his foe and be taken prisoner, to the proud joy of the king of the south, who shall rout tens of thousands of them. However, he shall not hold his own. The king of the north shall again raise an army larger than before, and finally, after some years, renew the attack with a large host and vast resources. That's the Moffat translation, through verse 13. Okay, so I'd say Howard Rand is doing a really good job of correlating these statements with, you know, Ptolemaic, the feud between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Okay. Do you have any correlation here with Muhammad or any other future?
Well, there's a lot of things that could be pointed to in the later times that could fit this.
Okay.
And I mean, some of it's vague enough that just about anything will fit into it. There were five Syrian wars. I'd like to give this more study.
Okay.
Because I don't see this being so short range. And okay. when we get five or six verses down, we'll see that.
Okay, well, here, let me, I believe I stopped in the King James after verse 10, and he already described how the king of the south was very angry. The King James puts it this way in verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he has taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. Again, the Moffat translation is just so much clearer in these verses. I finished with verse 13 from Moffat. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And, of course, by this he is talking about, according to Rand, Antiochus. Okay? Antiochus. Let's continue verse 14. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of your people shall exalt them, and the king of the south are the Ptolemies. Also the robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. Let me continue here. Let me read through verse 17 and then go back to Rand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. Of course, glorious land would be Palestine.
The Ptolemies are standing in Palestine all along. That's
yes.
No big thing.
Right, right.
So why is that such a big thing here?
Well, it's just it's talking about the locations that the Ptolemies controlled. However, Antiochus took control of the Holy Land away from him. Okay.
All right. I'd like to read from verse 9.
Okay.
So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return to his own land.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, when the Arab-Muslim conquest ended circa 786 B.C., there was no more Arab conquest or Arab moves against Christendom until the Seljuk Turks.
Okay,
For 300 years.
And they weren't really Arabs.
Well, actually, the Seljuk Turks were not Arabs. They were Seljuk Turks.
Right.
But they were acting against Anatolia and Byzantium in
yes.
the employ as mercenaries for Arab merchants.
Okay, I see.
Okay.
Very interesting. Okay.
Verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then he shall return and be stirred up even to his fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand, and when he taketh away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it.
Okay.
But a king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after years with a great army and with much riches.
Okay.
And this seems to be describing to me the later conquest under the Seljuk Turks, which were in the hire of the Arab sheikhs, And the reciprocation
yeah.
by the Greeks and the Franks and the forces under the Pope
okay.
and the Crusades.
Yes.
And the Popes wanted, and it says in verse 14, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south, and also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves. Who are the robbers of Daniel's people?
Mm-hmm.
Is the key. And we don't care about the Ptolemies and what they're doing to the Egyptians.
Right, right.
We don't care about the Seleucids and what they're doing to the Persians and
mm-hmm.
and the Hittites and the diverse people in Asia Minor.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, they're not the robbers of Yahweh's people or Daniel's people.
Right.
The popes, however, wanted to wanted this conquest for Christianity, and they were the ones that wanted to establish the vision.
Yes.
In other words, they ruled as Jesus Christ on earth.
Yes, yes. Well, now, in the book of Revelation, and Rand's book, study in Revelation, refers to the Arab Islamic conquest as the first woe.
Well, right, and I agree with Rand totally on that.
What you're describing falls in line with that as well, because he refers to the Turkish Muslim conquest as the second woe.
That's absolutely clear in the prophecy in Revelation chapter 9.
So
and
what
we
you're
discussed
describing
that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, what you're describing totally fits that interpretation of the book of Revelation.
But also, I can't fit all of this in here because my own knowledge of medieval history, I don't generally study medieval history.
Yeah.
But a lot
this
of
the
this
Dark Ages.
simply fits perfectly in with medieval history.
Right.
And it's too much, and some of the descriptions fit the papacy and fit the struggles between Imperial Rome and the Imperial – when I say Imperial Rome – I include the papacy in that, and because the papacy sure as hell was Imperial Rome,
right,
and the Muslim world.
Okay, well, up to this point, I'm the preterist, and you're the futurist.
but I can't, it does make sense. The first there were five major Syrian wars. Okay, between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. But I don't think that they are what is being described here, because a lot of the language actually transcends this little regional war between these two groups.
Well, I see both I see both of these interpretations working very well. Okay, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I see them both working very well. Okay,
right. Well, so, you're up to
I think I left off at 14 or 13?
I
went a little farther. Oh, Glorious 16. I think I ended at 16.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have any comments up to verse 16?
Now, 15 says that the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand him, neither his chosen people. And they're not the chosen people.
Right, his chosen people,
right.
It says, yes.
And actually, if the king of the south is to be interpreted as the Arabs, the Arab Muslim powers, then his chosen people may well be those Seljuk Turk mercenaries that he has fighting for.
Very good.
Okay,
very good.
Because they were all in the employ of Arab traders.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't truly a separate entity.
Okay.
The Arabs just took advantage of the influx of Turks into Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
And used them like the Jews used the Mexicans in America today.
Right. Well, when you say the word trader, T-R-A-D-E-R.
traders, the merchants. The Arab merchants.
Merchants, yeah. So, and we already know that Muhammad hired Jews to write, what the heck's their book called?
Well, right. The Arab merchants are definitely the powers behind behind Islam. There's
and
no
so
doubt.
Those Arab merchants quite possibly are, in fact, crypto-Jews.
Now it says in verse 16, "But he that cometh standeth against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him.
Mm-hmm.
But he," meaning the king of the north, that's how I read that, "shall stand in a glorious land, by which his hand shall be consumed." And I view that as the short-lived 12th century or 13th century victories that the Crusaders had in Palestine.
Fascinating.
Okay?
Yeah. Okay.
"And he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him." Now, that can't be talking about these Egyptians and these mutts in Arabia, I'm sorry. "Thus he shall do. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her."
Mm-hmm.
And the only significance that has to me is when Richard the Lionheart sat in Jerusalem with Saladin, the Arab mudball, and offered this Arab mudball his sister Joan in marriage as a truce.
He must have drunk some strong coffee to make that. Oh,
and what else could that mean? He shall give him the daughter of women corrupting her, is what the King James says.
Wow.
And I think that that signifies Richard the Lionheart's giving of his sister so that he can, come home and have bragging rights about getting the Christians access to Jerusalem.
Yeah, he actually did that, huh?
Yes, he did.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay. Well, here, let me read 17 and give Rand's interpretation. Again, it's Ptolemaic, okay? And then we can probably conclude on that because we're only about 5 minutes left, and we'll pick up Daniel 11:18 next time. But here, let me read verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, as you just said, corrupting her, but shall not stand on his side, neither before him. Okay, again, that's an awkward translation here. But here is Rand on this verse. Ptolemy Philopater, king of the south, was moved with anger and fought against Antiochus the Great, the king of the north, whose forces were taken by Ptolemy in a great victory. Ptolemy destroyed many, but he was not strengthened or able to hold his own, for Antiochus the Great gathered a much larger army and possessed plenty of wealth to carry on the campaign. Ptolemy saw his army destroyed. And here he's quoting again the Moffat translation. At that time, many shall rise against the king of the south, and some wild spirits among your own nations shall start up to fulfill the prediction of the vision, only to be routed. The king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and capture some strongly fortified towns. The southern power shall be powerless to resist. Their picked troops shall make no stand. The northern invader shall do as he pleases, with none to oppose him. He shall occupy the fair land of Palestine, holding it all in his hand, and then plan to advance against Egypt with the entire strength of his army. But he must come to terms and attempt to master Egypt by marrying the princess of Egypt. The plan will fail, and he shall not succeed. That is Rand's interpretation of the Moffat translation. Okay.
Well, that's all nice, but I think it transcends that. That's all.
Okay. Well, may very well. And again, this is dual fulfillment. You could both be right, okay? And I have no problem with that whatsoever, okay? So, folks, this book of Daniel is something else, isn't it? And then the book of Revelation is even more incredible.
Now let me go on and okay. I'm using Richard the Lionheart here as representing the King of the North.
Right, okay.
In verse 17.
Uh-huh.
And then verse 19. Verse 18 says, after this he shall turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many. Well, he took Cyprus and sold it to a Frank.
Okay.
Okay? And then it says...
For a Frank.
Well, he sold it to a Frenchman.
Yes.
He sold, I forget, his name was Guy something.
Okay.
But he actually took Cyprus and sold it to a Frenchman.
Okay.
Now.
I see Manhattan Island here.
But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease.
Yeah.
Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him.
Uh-huh.
On the way back to England, he was shipwrecked.
Okay.
And he was confiscated by Henry V and held for ransom.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Then he shall turn his face towards the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found.
Well, that's very fascinating.
And he goes back to Britain, where he's coronated for a second time because he had been gone for so long.
Yes.
Okay? And he don't stay. He goes to France, where he has holdings that he claims, and he dies in battle.
Uh-huh. So, the latter half of his reign was all in foreign countries. Yeah. And Robin Hood took the throne.
Well, when I went through it today and read about Richard the Lionheart and read this, and it fits him in every way.
It makes perfect sense. I mean, both what Howard Rand is transmitting and what you're transmitting both make perfect sense. And it's quite
Admittedly, I don't have the whole early picture,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of that may well apply to the Seleucids.
Yes.
But I think that a lot of it seems to fit better
mm-hmm.
Muhammad, and that's because he is the only one that came from that region that ever extended the boundaries with any success, you know, beyond
mm-hmm.
the boundaries of Alexander the Great.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Folks, that takes us to the end. We'll come back to verse 18, and then because I have some more quotes from Howard Rand in this regard. And we're talking about, in both cases, we have a historicist point of view where these verses are talking about actual history, okay? And it does not end in 70 A.D. It ends with the judgment day and the second coming and the wedding feast of the Lamb, okay? Those are the last prophetic events that I'm aware of, right? Are you aware of any prophetic events beyond the wedding feast of the Lamb?
No, of course not. I mean, there's, you know, the city descends from heaven and the wedding feast of the Lamb. And,
right, and the kingdom comes.
And
right.
And the rest of it's fluff. I mean, the rest
right.
of it, yeah, the rest of, you know, the tree bearing 12 manner of fruits.
Right.
It's all connected.
That's
you know,
right.
It's all.
Yeah, it's 12 tribes of Israel. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, very good. This has been loads of fun comparing these two interpretations. One being the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and the other being the Muslims, and of course, as you're pointing out, Richard Leinhardt,
the Imperial Romish clan,
European versus Islamic history. Very fascinating. Very fascinating indeed. Okay, so folks, thanks for tuning in again. We're going to continue this discussion in 1 week. That would be Christmas Day. Okay, so we will have a show Christmas Day that will be at the usual time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Okay, and then now tomorrow it's going to be Bill and Clifton. I have an event to attend, and so I won't be around tomorrow, but I'll be back Sunday with Pastor George Advari, and we're going to be discussing his Christian Israel reference manual, okay, study manual. So that should be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that interview. So. And between now and then, praise Yahweh. Thank you all. Thank you, Bill. And good night, everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thanks.